Good afternoon. Welcome to today's talk. Let's begin with some meditation as usual. Allowing the body and the mind to settle down. Letting this body relax. Letting go of all tension from the muscles of the body. I turn my attention inwards, letting go of all thoughts of the past and the future. Even as I can hear the sounds of the world around me, I focus my attention within, going deep within myself, separating myself from all thoughts. Of the activities, relationships, responsibilities of this physical existence. Turning my attention away from all the sensations, sounds, experiences of this physical world, I go deep within to the center of my being, experiencing my entire existence, concentrating, merging into a point of light. A sparkling star. My original and eternal form of the Spirit. Experience as though this physical body and the physical world has disappeared. All that remains is the eternal spirit, a beautiful, sparkling star. A being of peace, a being of love, a being of silence, and I see myself in a world of light. The dimension of silence, the invisible dimension. And I see myself in the presence of the Supreme, in the presence of God. The Supreme Light, a point source of infinite peace, unconditional love, unlimited purity. Showering rays of light and I, the eternal spirit, am absorbing this light into the very depths of my being. Healing, empowering, emerging the original stage of perfection. Fullness, bliss, just two sparkling stars of living, conscient energy. I, the eternal spirit, and he, the supreme spirit, lost in light, united. and holding on to this deep, blissful silence. Holding on to the awareness of being the eternal spirit. Holding on to the light of God. I allow myself to gently return back to this world of matter, this field of action, this theater of the world, back to this room and this body, this physical costume of mine. And once again I take my place, I, the soul, the eternal actor, looking out through these eyes, listening through these ears. Silent, peaceful, at peace with myself, at peace with the world. So good afternoon or good evening or whatever you call it. What do you say? You just say good day, don't you? Simple. Danish is a simple language. So when I came to Denmark 2.5 years ago now, it's been 2.5 years. 2.5 years, time flies by. And when I heard Danish for the first time, I had a very interesting response which many Danes could not understand. What was the response? I thought Danish was very sweet. They said, what? Danish? Sweet? I said, yeah, it sounds very nice through the ears. They said, what? No, Swedish is sweet. Danish is not sweet. These are the Danes telling me. No, Swedish is more musical. Danish is not musical. But somehow to my ears, Danish sounded musical. Now that makes me very strange, doesn't it? So, and then now, you know, I go out of Denmark and I come back to Denmark, I travel a little bit. And every time I come to Denmark, I feel I've come home. Well, that's very strange. I'm not Danish. I'm not Danish. How can I feel at home in a country that is not mine? I'm Indian. I'm supposed to feel at home when I go to India. Not when I come back to Denmark. That's really strange. That cannot happen. But you see, every time I come back, I really feel, I'm home. I sometimes feel moved. I remember once, a few months ago, coming back from one of my trips, and then the plane was touching down, and then I saw a sign that said Copenhagen. Obviously, this is Copenhagen. But I saw a sign that said, Copenhagen. I felt, that's so nice. Why do I feel like that? Am I a traitor to my country now? I'm supposed to be Indian. I'm supposed to like India. I'm supposed to say India is the greatest nation and the best nation in the world, and I love my country and all that stuff. Now I'm supposed to be a traitor to India? How does this work, really? I don't know. I remember the first time I went to Greece, and the plane touched down in Athens. I also felt that I've come home. Now this is really strange. This is getting really strange, right? There's something seriously wrong with me. How can this guy go around feeling every place is home? But that's how it is. And there are lots of other very strange things that I'm going to tell you about myself today. So you have to be very careful. The reason I'm saying this is, many times, you know, we've spoken about complexity. We are speaking about complexity now. In the previous session, we spoke about complexity. We spoke about complexity with regards to the self. How we experience the self to be, nowadays, especially in this world, a pretty complex entity. We have so many experiences coming from so many places. We have so many emotions. We have so many things within us that we have taken in from this world that forms what we call our identity, our likes, our dislikes, our tastes, our preferences. We have so many things. And it's important for us to understand this complexity. We spoke of this simple thing in the previous session, so we are looking at complexity. And we said the problem is complexity can appear to be extremely complicated, something that we cannot really make sense of when we do not understand it properly. It creates its complicated nature. However, we said that when we are able to actually understand the nature of complexity, reality can actually appear to be quite simple. Complexity can appear to be complicated. Complexity can also coexist as a very simple reality. Many a times, because complexity is so complicated, because we can't figure out how things are functioning, then we deny the complexity and we come to some very simplistic understanding of life, of people, of human beings, of human reality. So, for example, this guy is from India, so he's supposed to be like that. And things get stranger, because I actually like the cold. How can I be from India and like the cold? That doesn't make any sense at all, right? That's really, really strange. And there are many, many other things now which I will slowly disclose to you today, which are extremely strange. But, you know, putting that aside, the past couple of days, I was at a very interesting seminar. It was called Insight Denmark. So please don't close the door, Milda. It locks. Please don't close it. Let's keep it open, please. Please keep it open, because it locks, and if someone is out, then they can't get in. Thank you. Yes. So, So this was a very interesting seminar called Insight Denmark. So you had all these researchers, psychologists, linguists, anthropologists, coming and giving the take on various aspects of life in Denmark. Very, very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. And one of the presentations was on religion in Denmark. Now, is Denmark a religious nation? Are Danes a religious people? What will we say? No. And when you look at the statistics, there is hardly anyone in the church on a Sunday morning mass. Today I said, let me find that out for myself. So I went to church today this morning. I wanted to see how many people come for the mass. The church was actually closed. So I couldn't go in. Then I wanted to try another church. Then it began to rain, you know, Denmark. And so I just went home. But we know the statistics are there. Attendance in the church is very, very low. We know that. You don't speak so much about religion, you know, it's not something you do, that's not fashionable, you don't do that, you know. people speak about religion, that's your personal stuff. Don't bring it into daily discourse. Don't bring it into conversation. Nowadays, of course, people have taken it to many levels. So, if, for example, if it's a post cafe, they will. Many times I've seen people deliberately avoiding saying go post. They will say something like have a nice holiday or something like that. So even that is going out of the discourse. If it's Christmas, many times I've seen people making a deliberate choice of not saying go. They will say have a nice holiday and go fay, as they would say, or something to that equivalent. So we see that. There are statistics also that try to gauge how many Danes believe in God. How many Danes, but actually quite a few Danes believe in God. By the way, it's very interesting. And then, on the other side, so the thesis of this presentation was Denmark is a godless nation. So I asked, that sounds very strong, doesn't it? But you know, we researchers have to sell our product. So when we say godless nation, people pay attention, you know, it's very nice. So, Denmark is a godless nation. Okay, that's very nice. And then, you see this other side of Denmark. 70, I don't know exactly what the numbers are, 70 to 80% of Danes are members of the church. They pay taxes to the church, regularly, religiously. How do we explain this? It is a secular country, and yet the church is supported by the state. You don't see that in many countries. You don't see that in Sweden, for example. I don't know how it is in Norway, but you certainly don't see that. You don't even see it in a country like India, which is full of religion. The state doesn't support any particular religion. But you see that in Denmark. In India, people are speaking about religion all the time. And when you walk in the streets of India, there's religion blaring at you and attacking you from all sides that you can imagine. Right? Here you don't have that, and yet you have the state supporting the church very, very clearly. You have this big section of the Danish population, part of the church and contributing to the support of the church. You also have this. How do we put this together? So people have their own explanation. They say, oh, it's more fellowship. It's not really religiosity. It's other stuff. There are lots of explanations for this. Very interesting and intelligent explanations. However, there is another side of Denmark that is also very, very interesting. And this makes it so complex. You see, the Danes have some very clear, strong, non-negotiable rituals. And these rituals go from the dining table, to the office, to everywhere. And if you look at the Danish calendar, it's all organized around religious holidays. Everything is around Christmas and Easter and Kristi Himmelfartsdag and Storebæltedag and you know, all these things. Those are really the only holidays we have here in Denmark. All of them, almost all of them, except for maybe one or two, are religious holidays. Extensive holidays. And they're not just holidays. There is extensive preparation before. So if Christmas is on 25th December, now Christmas starts in November. You have all these frokosts and midas and whatnot, and this big ritual around it, and you have to have Ris Alamand, and then you have to have an almond hidden inside the Ris Alamand, and one person gets the almond, and then that person. There are these very strong rituals that are practiced religiously. No one negotiates around that. And you ask people, so why do you do? Oh, it's just a tradition. Okay, yes, of course, but there has to be a meaning behind the traditions, right? You have this other side of Denmark. You also have, in the very personality of the Dane, a very deep conscientiousness, a deep commitment to duty. They know their job. Tell them something, they will do it. If they have given their word, they will. But mostly, I hope, at least, the people I've met. You see that. There's also this whole thing of duty. So we can understand religiosity in many, many different ways. But you have this side. So you have on the one hand this very clear irreverence towards religion. You can make all sorts of jokes. You can do all sorts of things. You can print all sorts of cartoons. I mean, who cares? Yeah. And then you have this other side that is very clearly, very ritualistic, in some ways very religious. Very, very religious. So what do we call Denmark? A non-religious country? I don't know. I think it's a lot more complex than that.
But however, it is quite complex. We don't always understand that complexity. It just appears very complicated, especially, you know, for many foreigners. They come in and they see this, and then they see that, and they say, oh, these guys are just crazy, you know. So how are the Danes? Oh, they are just strange. Or they are just complicated, you can't figure them out. Or they put a category, they are non-religious. Or they are something else, whatever. You know, you would put a label to make it simple. The world appears to be very, very simple. We deny the complexity because we can't understand it, and we make it simple. Does it do justice to the country? And this is, you know, Denmark, I think, is a very interesting case. Scientifically, it's a very interesting case. A lot of cross-cultural studies in Denmark, they don't agree on what Denmark is all about. So when you look at cross-cultural studies, you have these two big, the two very famous models of looking at cross-cultural values. And one model that is by the Dutch psychologist Geert Hofstede, he says that Denmark is a very individualistic country, and the Danes are very comfortable with uncertainty. They're very, very flexible. They are open-ended. They don't focus on getting things, you know, closing things down. They're open-ended, flexible, open to uncertainty, highly tolerant of uncertainty, and very, very individualistic. There's another competing model called the GLOBE model, which is also pretty extensive research that is done, global leadership and organizational behavior effectiveness. They come out with another result, and they say Denmark is a very collectivistic country. And the Danes avoid uncertainty. They're very high on avoiding uncertainty. How do you feel? Now you have these two competing models giving completely opposite conclusions, arriving at very opposite conclusions. How do you figure that out? But if you observe things here in Denmark, you will see there are elements of both. There is a lot of organization and planning. I mean, you want to invite a Dane home for dinner or lunch? In 3 months, maybe. You need to plan in advance. You know, that was something I really had to get used to, you know. I was not used to planning so much. Now I'm sort of, I've become acculturated, as they say. Now I'm planning like 1 year in advance. That was unthinkable before. 1 year in advance, oh my God, that's ridiculous. 1 month, okay, maybe 3 months. 1 year? Whoa, I couldn't do that. Now I have to do it. I have to survive here, right? But anyway, but that's one thing. So you have this planning, long-term planning, organization, everything is planned and organized. On the other hand, you also have a lot of flexibility. You look at the Danish Union contract. It's not as extensive as the American Union contract would be. You have some broad outlines, you have some broad rules, and within that there is a lot of flexibility for negotiation. You wouldn't find that in Germany. You wouldn't even find that in the United States, where everything has to be clearly etched out. So you have both these dynamics. You have this organization and planning, and at the same time, you have this great deal of flexibility and open-endedness. The Danes are not so much bothered about getting things done. They're more bothered about the process of getting things done. Of course, they want to get things done, but the focus is on the process. And of course, because of that, Denmark also rates very high on innovation, because of the focus on the process and design. So you have this sort of complexity. You have this collective spirit in Denmark. You have the focus on the group and the harmony. And people say, Jantelong, you can't stand out. You can't teach me anything. You are not better than me and all that stuff. So the individual standing out and drawing attention to himself or herself is not necessarily the very best thing. At the same time, they are very individualistic people in many, many other ways. They like to decide for themselves. Children are taught to decide for themselves from a very young age. Sometimes some psychologists I've spoken to say, that's really confusing for kids. I mean, come on, the guy is 3 years old and you're asking, what do you want? He says, Daddy, just give me whatever, you know. What do you want? Is it okay if I buy you this? Is it okay if I buy you that? Oh, can you choose between these two? And some psychologists were telling me, that can be very confusing for young children because sometimes it's good for the parents to just decide for them. But you also have this other side. Young kids going, I've seen these small children going on their bicycles and the father or the mother is going behind them. It's like a duck with all the ducklings, you know. Very sweet. It's a nice picture early morning when I go, you know, the school near my house. It's a very nice picture. Now, I had friends who come down from the US and how can you just leave kids out like that on the streets? I mean, come on, you can't do that. and then the Danish mothers have the kids strapped on the back of their bicycles. Come on, I mean, that's crazy, that's dangerous. But see, there is a whole inculcation of individuality and independence and thinking for yourself. This is also a part of Denmark. At the same time, you do have this very strong group meeting together, Danish organizations. Many of my colleagues, you know, the CRIB, those who don't come from Denmark, at CBS, for example, we have so many meetings. I mean, there are meetings all the time. For everything, there is a meeting. And everything has to be discussed. And people just don't stop discussing. And after 3 hours, there's no conclusion. And they're okay with that. How on earth can you function in a place like this? But the place is functioning. The place is functioning reasonably well. So you have these opposites. This makes it really quite complex. And for a person, though, many of you born, brought up in Denmark, it's very natural to you. No, you don't think about it. Many people come from outside, it is because they can't understand it, it's complicated. It's different. And then because it's perhaps too difficult for us to understand, then you start stereotyping. Oh, they are like this, oh, they are like that, they are like that, they are like that. Yeah, they are all that, all together. That's the reality. Same thing, but again, when we look at the world around us, we can apply the same complexity to many, many countries. The country where I was born and brought up, India. It's also a very complex place. I don't know that because I was born and brought up there. So that's like, yeah, that's how things are for me. Just as, you know, those of you who are in Delhi, that's how things are. That's very natural for you. That's very natural for me. But you see, so many contradictions. Many foreigners, many of my friends from abroad who've come to India, who travel to India, some of them are really freaked out because it's so crazy. I mean, there are all sorts of contradictions. You look at India now, it is the 10th largest economy in the world, the 10th richest nation in the world. And yet, you have hundreds of millions of people who live below the poverty line. How can that be? In terms of gross national product, if you look at the purchasing power parity is if you adjust the wealth of the country to purchasing power, costs of living, etc., India then becomes the third largest economy in the world on basis of purchasing power parity. Third largest economy in the world, and yet you have hundreds of millions of people living below the poverty line. How can that be? It's just, you know, it doesn't seem like it. That's how it is. For us, you know, we grew up in India, yeah, that's how it is. That's life. You have this, if you go to a city like Bombay, you have this big skyscraper, supposed to be one of the most expensive residence buildings in the world by a big industrialist. It has a helipad, it has all sorts of things in it, and right next to it you have about 1 kilometer of slum. How do you make sense of that, these opposites? That's how it is. Can't understand it, it's just crazy, you know, can't figure it out. Otherwise, oh, it's just unfair, or it's, you know, we come to our own conclusions about reality. But the reality is the world is pretty complex. Forcing it to become simple is not going to make it simple. It's only going to be a simplistic understanding, which will only make things more complicated. And we can see that in relationships. I'll tell you a very funny example. Christina, are you here today? Good, she's not here. Because she's a friend of my landlady. I don't want this question. I'm sure my landlady wouldn't mind. She's a very sweet person. Perhaps one of the reasons I feel Denmark is home for me was because my first experience with Denmark was of home. Now, I sort of managed to find an apartment on the internet when I was coming here. Very nice people. They said, oh, don't worry. I said, do I need to send you money? They said, I don't. So you come. You stay here a few nights. If you don't like it, just leave. I said, okay, that's nice. So I came here. And then, of course, some people picked me up from the airport, some other friends from the center here. But they took me straight there. And, you know, the whole place was smelling of roses and perfume, and there were roses and flowers in the vase in my apartment. Everything was fully lit, everything pristine, white, you know, it was so beautiful. A hot jar of tea waiting for me, with some chocolates and cookies and all sorts of things. And then when I came in, she invited me to her place, and I sat with her and her husband, and we had a nice long chat for an hour. They wanted to know more about me, and we had some tea. It was like, you know, I come in. Maybe that's the association I have with this country, because my first experience of Denmark was actually, that was wonderful. So she's a wonderful person, a really wonderful person. And you know, we live in the same house. I have an apartment, it's a villa, and I have an apartment in the house. So we meet a lot. Every Christmas we have a Yule Frohpost, Frohpost, or sometimes villa, whatever. Every Christmas, always been there. And a few times in a year we have some get togethers. So, you know, we have our little hygge and all that stuff. And she introduced her friends to me. And very, very wonderful, lovely family. But a very funny incident, you know, about stereotypes and things like that. She did it, you know, it was very sweet of her. You know, 2 years ago, I think it was, we had this flooding in Copenhagen. So my apartment was flooded. Okay, so I was sleeping actually when the water was rising. And then somehow my landlord managed to bang on the door loudly enough, and I woke up and I saw, oh, okay. Water all around me. That was all fine. And then they all came down, and then we sort of worked the whole night to clear the water and all that, landlord, I, and another person, and his son. And then they said, okay, so you can't live here in this apartment now. It's, I mean, you know, this has to be cleaned properly. And they had some rooms upstairs. So they shifted me up to the room. And my landlady, she was so sweet. She went and she decorated the room the way she believed I would like it.
Yeah,
so she decorated it in lovely orange and red. Saffron, orange, and red. So I go up to this room and I walk in and I say, whoa. There's like, what's happening? And then she said, don't you like it? I said, yeah. I mean, poor thing. I mean, you know, she did it with so much love. I couldn't say I didn't like it. I was scared. I mean, okay, I wasn't scared, but I mean, orange is not my favorite color in the world. In fact, it's my least favorite color. So she said, do you like it? I said, yeah, it's very nice. She said, I knew you would like it because you come from India. You're Indian, you would like it, right? Because in India, you have all these red and orange and saffron in many places. Of course, being an Indian, I have to like saffron and orange and red. I can't be an Indian without liking that. But I'm sorry, I don't. I like blue and I like white and I like soft colors. But you know, that's what do I do? I couldn't say that to her. So 1 month I had to live in a room with red and orange and saffron. What do? I tell her I don't like it? I can't do that. I said, oh, maybe I can learn to like orange and saffron and red. And it wasn't too bad. It was okay. I didn't have any anxiety attacks. I didn't need any depressive, antidepressants or anything. It wasn't too bad. But we do, we look at a reality that is quite complex around us. We make it simple. In the process of making it simple, we carry our own biases, our own prejudices. We have our own assumptions. That makes the world simple, right? We have our diet. We know how the world is. It makes it simple. It saves, psychologists say, it saves the energy we would otherwise spend on trying to figure out too many things. Make it simple, the world becomes clear, we can live with it. We can go on and do other stuff. Okay. Of course, in some cases, like the incident that I mentioned, it's harmless. It doesn't really matter. I mean, red, orange, white, okay, one can live with that. That's okay. In some cases, it can be a little more difficult. Then we carry prejudices and assumptions. So many times, you know, I meet people and I say, in India itself, one part of my family lives in this place called, many of you may not, I think none of you may know about this place, it's called Bihar.
I know, I've been
there. Oh, you've been there? Okay, that's interesting. Bihar is supposed to be one of the most backward parts of India. Not one of the most, perhaps the most backward part of the country. It's supposed to be the most corrupt. You have these stereotypes. It's supposed to be the most corrupt, with the most violent people coming from there, highest rates of crime, highest rates of lawlessness. All the negative stereotypes that you can imagine in India, Bihar is the favorite punching bag. Anything goes wrong, that's Bihar. Like, you know, we have favorite punching bags in different parts of the world. So there, that's, a part of my family is from there. And my family is actually, you know, ordinary people. They don't go around shooting people and stuff.
they're okay, quite well educated, mostly doctors and engineers and professors and stuff like that, but they happen to live in that place. At the same time, that place is very, very rich. There are lots of very rich people there. It's like, if you say India is a contrast, Bihar is the ultimate contrast in India. It's the ultimate contrast. You have people who are so rich you can't even imagine. And then you have like abject poverty, extreme depths of poverty coexisting. And so I come from there. And so every time in India, I face that in India, you know, I meet people and I say, oh yeah, nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. So where are you from? You know, people ask that everywhere, don't they? Where you from? So like there in India, so where are you from? I say, oh, you know, a part of me, I'm from Bihar. And the moment I say Bihar, the face changes. Well, you liked me 2 minutes ago. What happened now? Just because I uttered a word? But the stereotypes, they kick in. The assumptions kick in. I have that experience many times outside India. I go meet people, say, hello, how are you? Oh, very nice to meet you. Oh, wonderful, yeah, very nice time. Where do you come from? I come from India. Oh, India, oh, wonderful, this funny little country, it's very exotic. Everybody likes it so much. Oh, wonderful, really, India, where in India, blah, blah, blah. But you know what? You don't look like a typical Indian. How can that be? I say, well, you know, actually, my four elders came from the Middle East. The face changes. What happened? We're having a nice conversation, you know. The face changes. And then I can be a little more stupid sometimes. So I go one step further. I said, you know what? Actually, my first name, that's Sayyid. You don't know what Sayyid is. Oh, a big thing is coming your way. So it's not my first name. It's actually a title. My name is Salman. But that's the letter that first stands in my name, Sayyid. And Sayyid is a title given to the direct descendants of Muhammad. Ooh, now who is this guy? He's just about to press a button somewhere and, you know, blow himself up or something like that. The body language changes, everything changes. What do I do there? I say, hey, I'm not going to make it so easy for you to hate me. So I go after them because I feel it's my responsibility to help them confront these prejudices. Yes, of course there is a problem out there. There is extremism out there. There is terrorism out there. It is difficult, and that's fully understandable. But at the same time, such attitudes create a lot of problems in the world. Some people, you know, you can imagine, everybody will not be able to confront this reality very peacefully. They get disturbed. I come and I meet you having a nice conversation. The moment you find out something about my roots, you change your attitude. Most people can't take that. And then what happens? You push me into a corner, and then I believe I have to sort of defend my identity. And all these divisions happen, and then a lot of problems develop. Because we carry these biases, prejudices, assumptions that, of course, are informed by certain insecurity. It's informed by our ego identity, which we know is created on insecurity, because identity we create because we want to make things certain for ourselves. Who am I? I am this, I am this, I am this. And it creates many, many problems in the world. So what do we do with this? We just wish it away? We say it's not there? What do we do with this? There has been a lot of research by a psychologist at Harvard, Robert Putnam. Many of you may know about him. And he's done a lot of work on trying to understand how does complexity, especially when we look at groups of people who are very, very different to each other. So for example, complexity is reflected very often in this world in plurality. Right? Different people living together. And we see that in the globalizing world, that happens more and more and more. Lots of people living together of different ethnic backgrounds, of different religious backgrounds, living together. And we are seeing that happening more and more in the world. And we are seeing lots of problems because of that. That's a fact. We know that. Even in Denmark, we know that. That's a fact. That is a problem. Coming from a place like India, which is, I think, certainly the most diverse country in the world, where you have people of all sorts of races and religions and ethnic backgrounds living all together, you can see that there is a problem even there. Robert Putnam, he did a lot of studies on trying to find out how do people experience themselves and others when they're living in these heterogeneous communities. Most of his research is in America, but there is a very clear pattern. Guess what the pattern is? The more homogeneous, you know homogeneous? More of the same kind. The more homogeneous a society is, the higher is the level of trust. And the lesser homogeneous a society is, the lower is the level of trust. There's a very clear line. A very, very clear line.
What do you say? Trust?
Trust.
Trust, yes.
Trust. How would you say that? Yes, that's the thing. And then, of course, there are other people who've done research on this as well, including some researchers at Aalborg here in Denmark and many other places. And it's sort of being replicated. Wherever you have societies that are more and more heterogeneous, different people living together. And so one hypothesis is when people of different groupings come together, actually the contact should make things better. But if that contact is not facilitated, the research says that it doesn't necessarily make things better if it is not organized and facilitated. So people end up having higher levels of mistrust. Why does that happen? Why does that happen?
Because they don't understand each other and they don't know what you are if you're different from me.
They are from new things.
Fear of new things. It creates an insecurity in us, perhaps because it threatens our ego identity. We have this understanding of who we are, who we should be, not just who we are, but who we should be in order to be a person of worth, in order to have some sort of a standing in this world, in order to be secure. I believe who I should be. And when I come into contact with these people who are so very different from me, in some way that could threaten my ego identity. I end up feeling insecurity, and obviously that leads to mistrust, which only increases the insecurity. And when the insecurity increases, I clamp down. The ego identity gets further tightened. It gets further tightened, I develop further biases and prejudices because I believe, now I know how these people are. It makes me feel in some way secure, but in reality it doesn't, because that is just a simplistic understanding of reality. It makes things only more complicated. And then I sort of go through this cycle of being threatened by the plurality, feeling insecure, deepening the mistrust, feeling more insecure, deepening my prejudices, tightening my identity, feeling more threatened, and so on. The cycle increases. And of course, then it's very, very difficult. And so you have groups of people living together which become more and more and more antagonistic towards each other. Now, this is a phenomenon we see everywhere in the world. We see this in a country like India. We're seeing it in Denmark. We're seeing it everywhere. So then what's the solution? Have more homogeneous societies? That's a solution proposed by many political parties, right? It's a problem. So just remove everyone, have one society, you feel good, you feel safe. In some cases, like for example in Germany, during the Second World War and before that, we go to extremes of ethnic cleansing. We've also seen it in Bosnia, we've seen it in other places in the world, where people want to forcefully remove those who are not like us, so that we can feel safe and secure. So is that the solution? Can we really stop this world from becoming more and more plural and complex? Can we really stop? Can, for example, let's take one country, let's take Denmark. Can Denmark just exist in isolation? Can Denmark even survive and grow without foreign trade? So difficult. And this is not a situation that is unique for Denmark. I suppose it's a situation that is relevant to each and every country in the world. In a globalizing world, we are also interdependent. We can't exist anymore in this world of independence and say, okay, so we just stay together and we stay one and we are fine. Of course, when we are with those who are similar to us, we feel secure. We assume we are secure. But there is an insecurity there, which I just push away because I imagine I create an illusion of security because I am with people who I call my own. And so the moment I'm exposed to something different, other ways of doing things, other ways of looking at things, and that seems to also be working. Oh, wow. But how can that work? This is supposed to work. And then all these issues, and then we have this big eruption of problems and the mistrust. Denmark, by the way, is supposed to have one of the highest levels of trust in the world. Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, the first four countries. Highest levels of trust in the world. General trust. People trust systems, people trust each other. But they are also one of the most homogeneous societies in the world. By the way, Denmark, for example, even today, around 90% of the population of Denmark are ethnic Danes. This immigration thing is something new that has begun maybe over the past few decades here. It's something new. People are getting used to it. But till now, there is a very high level of trust. And so people argue, one of the reasons is it's a very homogeneous society. It is still there. But people are coming in. What to do now? Throw them out? That's one solution, throw them out. But can the country really survive like that, just throwing people out? You know, that's not going to happen. It's very, very tough. Can it survive? Maybe it can, I don't know. But it seems to be difficult in a globalizing world. Especially, you know, in a country like Denmark, you have the welfare state, which probably also contributes to the experience of trust. Because there is always someone to take care of you. So you can sort of fall back on that safety net. So you have all these things, but to support the welfare state, you need money, and, you know, you can't keep taxing your people. I mean, where will they get their money from? You have to go and work in some other places, and it's just a complex world. Sometimes complicated, people would say. But that's the reality. That's the reality around us. We feel uncomfortable with those who are unlike us. Let's take it down to the level of one-to-one interpersonal relationships. So we're looking at large social groups, but one-to-one interpersonal relationships. Do we sometimes end up taking people for granted, especially the husband and the wife and the children and the boyfriend and the girlfriend? Do that? Why do we do that? Oh, he likes this, she likes that, she doesn't like that, she likes that. Take things for granted. And then our attitude towards them is informed by that approach, by the bias, by the prejudice that I am holding inside me. And then, I, of course, living together with people for a long time, you do get to know a lot about their tastes and preferences. But sometimes you... What happens when this... Any thoughts? What happens when we start taking people for granted? We have certain assumptions and biases about who they are, how they are. We also say, yes?
I think they lose their importance. Somehow, and everything is feeded by expectations. So they become a lot of expectations in the air, and then the other person can't live up to them, and then there's a lot of in quarreling. And
can we also then look at it within this whole context of complexity and making things simple? How do I trust my partner? How do I trust? On what basis do I base my trust? How do I base my trust in a relationship? On what do I base it? Yes?
Behavior.
Behavior. So if a person behaves in a certain way, that person can be trusted. But that's the thing, see, if I was a Muslim woman and wearing a burqa, I would be behaving very different. Nowadays, it's quite fashionable to call it a tent. So I would be wearing a tent. How do you trust a person who's wearing a tent? Whoa! How do you trust a person with a long beard, with a shaved mustache, and wearing a sort of a cap on the top of the head? Whoa! They're very different. They speak differently, they eat differently. I say, hey, the guy drinks alcohol, I can't trust. He says, hey, the guy doesn't drink alcohol.
That's worse.
That's even worse. But you know what? I've been invited to so many Danish homes, really, so many. People say, well, come to Denmark, it's very difficult to be invited to a Danish home. I'm sorry. I've been invited to plenty of them. I don't drink alcohol. I don't eat meat. You know, I don't even eat onion and garlic. That's very, very strange. I still get invited. I sit and I watch people getting drunk. I have my milk, you know.
I've been having the whole bean and this bean and all the different sizes and shapes of the glasses and going skol. I do skol with my milk and my water. Why is it that we base our trust on the way people behave? Of course, what you said is also very deep. For example, behavior can also mean, I mean, you do something to harm me, then obviously, I mean, it's difficult for me to trust you then. Or is it? Or is it really, if someone has done something that I believe has hurt me, or that has hurt me, I can't trust that person anymore? Where does hurt come from? The situation? What in that situation? Where does hurt? Why do I get hurt?
Insecurity.
Insecurity. Why do I get hurt? Insecurity. And what does insecurity lead to? Yes.
Or it depends on your willingness to look inside and not just disbelieve to the other, but ask the question as a person. In fact, right.
Yeah. Any other experiences? Yes.
You are dependent on the person. Dependent.
I am dependent on the person and therefore I allow myself to get hurt. In fact, many, many times the person might not have had any bad intentions. Many a times. It's not that the person has had bad intentions. I perceive it in that particular way because I want something because of my own insecurity. I want that person's behavior to make me feel good. And when that's not happening, when he or she is not saying the right things, doing the right things, I get affected, I feel hurt, I take hurt because of my own ego. There is no other reason for hurt, especially in close interpersonal relationships. If we can recognize that, then we can learn to live with people. It doesn't matter, they've done something, you know, they've done one bad thing. They've also done many good things. And you know, I keep repeating this, a lot of research in psychology shows people tend to remember negative experiences 5 times more than positive experiences. So one psychologist has come up with a formula for an effective marriage. Boom, you need to listen to this. He's getting married soon. So he's come up with a very effective formula for proper, nice marriages and partnerships. So he says, because we have this tendency of remembering negative events 5 times more than positive events, for a marriage to work, you need to have 5 times as many positive experiences as negative experiences. How do you do that? You sit and calculate every day. Yeah? That becomes really tough, doesn't it? But at least to understand that my hurt can very often come from my focusing, from my deliberate choice to focus on some experiences and not focus on many other experiences. For every one negative experience, there are at least 5 positive experiences there, which I am not looking at. And so, is it possible for this one person to behave in such nice ways and also in this nasty way? Yes. Of course. Is it not possible for me to be nasty and nice at the same time? That's the complexity of the human personality. There is plurality within each one of us. We all have our own ego identity. We all feel our threats. We all feel our insecurity. And because of that, we have our expectations and therefore we can experience. So can we hold this complexity in our mind when we are dealing with relationships and understand, yes, this person has done something which is not really very nice. Person has also done many, many other things which are very, very nice. And it's the same person. Can we hold this in our mind? What do we need to hold that in our consciousness, in our awareness? Similarly, when we look at large groups, nations, groups, societies, nations, yeah, the people do all sorts of things in the world. But you know what? It's also a question of what we choose to focus on. Nowadays, there is a lot of talk in the media for many years now, right, on terrorism. It's a great threat to the world. It's a great problem for the world. Do you know how many people die from terrorist acts every year all across the world? Do you know that?
It's around 14,000 or 16,000, something like that. And do you know how many people die by gun violence in America alone every year? 32,000. What are we focusing on? How many people die in road accident deaths in the OECD countries every year? The figure is more than 100,000. What do we choose to focus on? Why do we choose then to focus on? And in these OECD countries, how many people have died out of terrorist attacks in the past 10 years? It's minimal. It's a double-digit number. I don't remember it clearly. I have those statistics, but it's a double-digit number, 30 or something like that. In America, for the past 10 years, how many people have died through terrorist acts? It's a little more than 3,000, out of which the World Trade Center attack was close to 3,000 itself. Little more than 3,000. And in the same country, people die by gun violence around 32,000 every year on the average. So we are looking at this world. We also learn to choose. We choose to focus on some information over other information. Why? Is it because that fits in with our prejudices and assumptions better? That makes us feel more secure in some way? Are we trying to push away a part of this complex reality of the world where many youngsters are going and killing themselves on the streets because of drunken driving and all sorts of problems? We ignore that. We ignore the danger of gun violence in many, many countries. In Denmark, it's not there so much, but in America, of course, it's a big problem. And we choose to focus on one problem, and by choosing to focus on that problem, are we actually creating it and making it even stronger? You know very well, lots of experiments which speak about when you focus, when you believe someone is like that, you sort of make them like that, right? People say Pygmalion effect. Lots of studies on this. I think we've spoken about this before as well. So I believe that you are capable. I will behave with you in that way, and you will actually respond in that way, and you will demonstrate your capability. I feel you are useless. You would probably end up behaving like lots of studies from the classroom, from the education system. Many of you would know this. Some of you are teachers. Many of you, some of you are psychologists. You would know this. It happens. The same thing, can we not apply that to individual relationships, group relations, international relations? Are the same dynamics happening? I'm focusing on a particular thing. This is the problem. This is the problem. And you are responsible for that problem. You are responsible for that problem. The person actually takes that responsibility and becomes responsible for that problem, because I have dumped it upon them. What is my role? So when I'm looking at one-to-one intimate relationships, if that person is behaving in a certain way, to what extent am I responsible for that? How have I created that? How have I created that part of that person? Can we look at that? Now, this is the way of looking at the complex reality around us. But for that, obviously, I need, you know, if you look at it, one thing that I certainly need is a sort of a detachment from this ego identity, which I hold on to. I need to sort of move away from this. When I move away from this, I also let go of this. Because all these biases and prejudices and assumptions are based on the experiences I have had and the experiences I choose to remember, the experiences I choose to identify with. They are based on that. If I can move away from that, in addition, if I can have an understanding of the complexity of the world, of the plurality of the world, but more importantly, beneath all that complexity and plurality, if I can understand very deeply the spiritual oneness, perhaps I can make my life reasonably simple. And it's not as simple at the expense of the complex and plural realities around us, but it coexists with the plurality, it coexists with the complexity, because that's how the world is. There is a deep spiritual truth that unites us in terms of core values, core assumptions about love and happiness and peace. And yet, there is a reality around us which is at the level of the ego that divides us. And that is a reality. There are important differences. These need to be respected. You can't just shove them under the carpet and imagine they are gone. They are there. There are problems. There are realities. Can we hold both these realities in front of us, the conflicting realities of the world that create the complexity, at the same time, the deep spiritual oneness that we can see, if we want to see, the knowledge and the detachment? So we say, understanding of that spiritual reality as well as the complex reality, plus the practice of detachment. So we say, for the practice of detachment, we speak about it very often as the power of transformation. We will speak about two powers today. That is, I am working from the space. And in this space, I feel the plurality and the complexity to be complicated. I make it simple. I feel insecure. I need to transform this. Detachment is transforming this and moving to a different space. At the same time, I also need understanding, and I'm running out of space, but anyway, and for that, I need the power of recognition, or the power of knowledge, whatever you want to call it, power of recognition. In the practice of Raja Yoga, we say transformation comes through the practice of yoga or union. And power of recognition comes from the basic spiritual knowledge of three forms. Knowledge of the spiritual reality, knowledge of the soul, knowledge of God, and knowledge of the world, the whole world. Now you will say, knowledge of the world, that's too big. I can't study all the subjects in the world, but it's not about going into the details of all these subjects, but understanding the basic principles through which the world operates. We say the principles of karma. The basic principles of action and reaction, the basic principles through which the world operates. When we can have this, when we can hold this knowledge in our awareness, and then go into the stage of yoga that is union with my inner self and with God and with the whole of humanity, from that powerful combination of knowledge and yoga together, I develop the power of transformation and the power of recognition. I hold the knowledge at the back of my mind. I can recognize what is happening in my mind. Am I breaking down a complex reality into a simplistic, assumption-based understanding of reality coming from my biases and prejudices? Or am I really looking at the complex reality as it is? I need a base of knowledge to understand that. And then when I understand that, I can move away from this space of the ego and experience that union with my inner self and with God, which will release, which will transform that experience of insecurity. And it will then give me the power to look at complexity, hold complexity in my consciousness and not be afraid of it, not get confused because of it, but hold it because it is a complex world and it is going to get more and more complex. Isn't it? And we need to learn to navigate this world without feeling insecure and uncertain. I say, wherever I go, I feel a sense of belonging deeply. I'm not saying this just for the sake of saying it. I feel a deep sense of belonging. And I know it comes from my spiritual understanding. I've lived in the Middle East, I've lived in India, I've lived in Denmark, I've traveled around Europe. I don't feel cut off from any place I've been in. I feel home. I feel home because this is my family. These are my people. There are differences. Of course there are differences. I come with a certain baggage and others have a certain baggage. I need to respect that. But there are core similarities. And this is probably what is captured in Nordic mythology in the eye of Odin. We always speak about it. It's my favorite example from Nordic mythology. How many of you don't know about this? The eye of Odin? Okay. So Odin, you know, is the chief of all the gods, the Nordic in Nordic mythology, the father of Thor and all Loki and all these other funny characters, very interesting characters. But Odin is the father of the gods, like Zeus is to Greek mythology, Odin is to Norse mythology, and Indra is to Hindu mythology or Indian mythology. So Odin is the chief of the gods. He is the ruler of Asgard, the
the realm of the gods. And very interesting story, mythology, right? Very interesting story. Odin learns about the spring of wisdom. There is a spring of wisdom, which is under the roots of the tree of the universe. It is called Yggdrasil. Odin wants to go and drink from that well, obviously, because he wants all the wisdom in the world. He wants to secure his position. He's feeling insecure, you see. So he wants to secure his position as the chief of all the gods. So he wants to drink from that well, and he goes there. And then there is a guardian of the well, Mimir. And he says, well, you can drink from the well, but to drink from the well, you have to give one of your eyes as a pledge. So Odin gives one of his eyes as a pledge, he drinks from the well, and of course, he remains the ruler of Asgard. And then from that day, Odin saw only through one eye. What's the meaning of that? As I understand it, it's the power of going beyond duality. Seeing oneness. There is duality, there is plurality in the world. But in the midst of all this plurality, this complex reality in which we live, I see oneness. Not a superficially imposed oneness, but a deep understanding of oneness, because spiritually, we're all the same. As souls, we're all one family, we are the children of one God. That simple, one understanding, one eye. This is also symbolized in the eye of Shankar in Hindu mythology. He has a third eye here. You know, very powerful. When it opens, everything gets burnt. That's destructive. But the meaning is, of course, the destruction of evil. These symbols are there all across the world in many, 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 many places. Okay. Any questions? Any thoughts? Suggestions? Yes, Bo?
I always think understanding and knowledge is a very demanding.
It is very demanding. Task. It is very demanding.
You mentioned one word, respect, which I find maybe even as useful. Especially if you marry it to curiosity, because then it ultimately will lead you towards knowledge and understanding.
Yes, I think that's a very good take on it. Being curious, because obviously knowledge, the attainment of knowledge, it's a big task. But at least if I can be curious about experiences, if someone has done something which I perceive to be nasty, if I can just be, instead of judging that person and coming up with a prejudice, if I can just be curious, what could have made that person behave like this? Let me ask her. Many times you will discover that there was a very clear and justified reason for that. You see? But we don't even do that. Let me be curious. Let me find out. Without feeling threatened and insecure and terrible, let me try and find out. It sometimes works very well. I think that's a very nice way of approaching it. Understanding knowledge through curiosity. And slowly, slowly I learn. And that knowledge then helps me in connecting with myself and with others. And that is what we call yoga. The union with the self and with others and with God. That's yoga. And it's something to be practiced in our daily life. Yes?
Do you think there is space on the board that where you can put the two names you mentioned of psychologists, Hollandish and American? Because I want to take a photo afterwards and then...
One is Gert Hofstede. The other model I mentioned was Globe. And the American guy I spoke about was Robert Putnam. Okay, Robert Putnam. He's the guy who did work on trust and homogeneous cultures. And these are the two studies on cross-cultural values.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So... with that, I think we stop the talk for today, but we hope to begin again in the autumn with a new series. Those of you who are on the mailing list will be informed. Those of you who are not on the mailing list and would like to be on the mailing list, so you get information about the various programs we have, there are some yellow cards back there that you can sign on. If they are not there, you could just leave your email on... piece of paper there with Azam, who's sitting there. You could do that. And many of you know we have started a course in English. Some of you were not there. A meditation course in English we have started. Those of you who would like to do a meditation course in English, we finished one session on Friday, but you can still join. There is place. So you can come from next Friday if you want. It begins at 7:30, not here, but at the center on Bodroswai. We have three more sessions left for the basic ground course of meditation. I would recommend Those of you who have not done the ground course of Raja Yoga Meditation, the basic course, I would recommend that you do it, because a lot of these concepts that we speak about, for example, knowledge of the self, knowledge of God, knowledge of the world, knowledge of creation and time, knowledge of karma, these are things that we go into in great detail during the meditation course. And for a sustainable practice of spirituality, Raja Yoga, it's useful to go into the depths of these concepts. So I would recommend that you do it. We have courses running in Danish as well as in English. So you can check up on the website and find out. We have some brochures back there. You can pick them up and look up on the website. That's about it. If there is anything you would like to ask before I wish you a very nice summer, you can ask. No? It's very nice to have people who don't ask so much. So we will conclude with a little meditation before we wind up for today. Separating myself from all thoughts of the past, of the future. I move away from the world of extroversion into the world of introversion. Withdrawing my attention from the world around me to the world within me. And going deep within. I experience once again my entire existence converging, concentrating, merging into a point. A point of light. Energy concentrated to infinity. The soul, the spirit, that energy which was before this body was, that which will be after this body is no more. My original and eternal existence. Free from the bondage of experiences of this physical world. I experience this physical body and this physical world disappear, merging into the distance. And all that remains is the eternal form of the soul, a point of light. A being of peace. And in this consciousness I see myself beyond space, beyond time, in the invisible dimension of light. And I see myself in the presence of the Supreme, in the presence of God. And I place myself under the light of the ocean of peace. Letting this light flow into me, filling me up from deep within. In this consciousness, I see a multitude of living beings, sparkling stars of light. Billions of them, my family of humanity. And I feel connected to each and every one of them. And every one of them. All together sparkling under the light of God. Experiencing the deep spiritual oneness of humanity. At peace with myself. At peace with the world. Letting the light of God flow into me. And through me outwards. All around me. Touching the hearts of humanity. And holding on to this consciousness, this light,
and this experience of connectedness with the whole universe, with the whole of humanity. I allow myself to gently return back to this world of matter, this world of duality. And once again I take my place in the center of the brain, looking out through the windows of these eyes, listening through these ears. I, the Eternal Spirit, ready to engage with this world of plurality, this world of complexity, on my own terms, detached, peaceful. I am a being of light, a being of peace, just as every other soul in the world originally a being of light, a being of love, a being of peace. Om Shanti. Okay, tak for today. Have a very nice summer time and hope to look forward to seeing you all in autumn again.